for a number of years at BYU, and for the last 2.5 years has been doing freelance work and currently lives in New Orleans. The title of his paper is Beyond the First Presidency, New Plural Marriages in the Church, 1890 to 1904. You'll be interested to know that the comments for this session will come from you. There are no designated commenters, so we'll take care of that at the end. Mike?
I'll give a summary, and we're going to do things, or I'm going to do things, with the subject of plural marriage after the manifesto, somewhat different than I've done them before in that, although I'll give a brief summary of the institutional leaders, the males, general authorities who were involved. After that overview, primarily statistical, I'm going to focus then on women and look primarily at the women who became involved as plural wives, and then one prominent example of a first wife who was involved with her husband in inviting into the home new plural wives. As a summary, between 1890 and 1904, Wilford Woodruff and Joseph F. Smith as church presidents specifically authorized new plural marriages and delegated others to perform them, while publicly and privately denying that they were doing that. President Woodruff himself married a new plural wife on the Pacific Ocean in 1897, and after his death, his family had this marriage entered as a permanent record of the Salt Lake Temple by reperforming it as a proxy ceremony, which was what post-manifesto polygamists were told to do, to have the marriages that had been performed outside the temple performed again when able. President Lorenzo Snow, however, consistently opposed new plural marriages. In fact, he even opposed the cohabitation of men with wives married after the manifesto, although there were some exceptions. He cohabited with his plural wife, and she bore a child. She made a special trip, almost last gasp, really, literally, into Canada, barely crossed the border, and one day later went into labor and bore his child 6 years after the manifesto. And then by 1900, he had adopted publicly a position of discouraging and even in telling men to discontinue cohabitation with wives, plural wives married before the manifesto. He was quite consistent in his opposition to new plural marriages with two exceptions. And in his mind, I think he saw those as consistent with his otherwise opposition or general opposition to new plural marriages. He knew that Matthias F. Cowley had received a special commission to perform plural marriages. That special commission came directly through First Counselor George Q. Cannon, although it was with the knowledge and permission of the President of the Church, Wilford Woodruff. After George Q. Cannon died and Lorenzo Snow became president of the church. He was president of the church, and Lorenzo Snow did not want to inquire what George Q. Cannon, his own counselor, was doing. When Cowley went to George Q. Cannon, to Lorenzo Snow, and asked for permission in addition to what George Q. Cannon was giving him, Lorenzo Snow said, "I don't want to interfere with any of President Cannon's unfinished business." So he, in this case, he felt what was going on had been started and put in motion before he became church president, and he simply did not want to know about it. And so that was, in his mind, consistent with an otherwise very adamant opposition to new plural marriage. I'm not exactly sure whether this related to Cowley or not, but temporarily he also authorized Heber J. Grant to marry a new plural wife in 1901, but then within a few weeks rescinded that, had second thoughts, and told Heber J. Grant not to. If we look at the counselors were all heavily involved in post-1890 plural marriage too. If we look at the men who served only as apostles between 1890 to April 1904, here is the summary of their post-manifesto activity. These are men who always remained in the Quorum of the Twelve, who never served in the First Presidency. And the reason I'm focusing on this is my article in Dialogue, which you may have read, focuses primarily on the First Presidency. And from this point on, this is not material that we would have seen there. Of these men who served only as apostles, eight married plural wives after the manifesto. This included Brigham Young Jr., George Teasdale, John W. Taylor, Mariner W. Merrill, Abraham H. Cannon, Matthias F. Cowley, Abraham Owen Woodruff, and Roger Clausen. All of these men married their plural wives in Utah or Idaho. None of them went across the border. This is another characteristic of plural marriage after the manifesto, is that in general there was a pecking order. If you were well connected in church office, your marriages were performed close at home. If you weren't well connected, you took a long trip into Mexico. And usually it was a quick round trip, just simply for the purpose of the marriage. And so that not only the general authorities, but stake presidents and patriarchs, most bishops did not make a long journey to obtain the plural marriage. It was performed close at home, either in Utah or in Idaho. In one case or two, a couple of cases in Colorado. But most of them within the mountain states. Again, returning to these 16 men, half married plural wives after the manifesto. Three performed new plural marriages for others, even though they themselves did not enter into plural marriage. These included Apostles Franklin D. Richards, Francis M. Lyman, and Heber J. Grant. Two apostles arranged for new plural marriages, but they did not themselves perform new plural marriages, nor did they enter into new plural marriages. So they distanced themselves, when you see the men who did it, you'll see that these were very political men. The two were Moses Thatcher and John Henry Smith. Only three did not participate at all. Only three of the men who were only apostles between 1890 and April 1904. Only three did not participate at all, at least that I've been able to determine, in post-manifesto polygamy. Those were Apostles Reed Smoot, Hiram M. Smith, and George Albert Smith. Although Hugh B. Brown, in his reminiscences, lists Hiram M. Smith as being one of the advocates of plural marriage who tried to talk Hugh B. Brown into entering into plural marriage. I haven't found verification of that aside from a reminiscence that's about 70 years old. And so I don't know how to react to that statement by Hugh B. Brown. But at the local level, the First Presidency delegated two stake presidents and two patriarchs to perform post-manifesto plural marriages in Canada and Mexico. And those continued down to 1906. In a statistical summary, about 275 new plural marriages occurred between the 1890 manifesto and the end of 1904. And at the time of the ceremonies, the husbands had these highest church offices. Again, my focus has tended to be institutional, and so that's a kind of a bias you're going to have to suffer with. As a rundown then, one church president, these are men who, prominent church officers who married after polygamously between 1890 manifesto and 1904, at the end of 1904. One church president, eight apostles, one member of the Council of 70, eight members of the auxiliary general boards, 19 current or former mission presidents, 10 stake presidents, 11 stake presidency counselors, four stake clerks, 30 stake high councilmen, 3 patriarchs, 19 local 70s quorum presidents, 21 bishops, 11 bishopric counselors, 5 ward clerks, and 1 president of BYU. That doesn't tell the whole pattern, though. either, because there were a number of men who wanted to marry plural wives who for one reason or another didn't. Because the practice was secret, and in fact this pattern had actually occurred even before the manifesto, when because of the law there was a necessity for secrecy, you never knew who was somebody else's plural wife. You had no idea. And there were a number of instances that I've found in diary references where a man would be courting, in his mind, he was courting and getting ready to announce his intention and his interest in marrying this woman as a plural wife, and she was dating him as a cover to protect her actual plural husband. And then he would pop the question, and then she would have to do fancy footwork to avoid explaining, you know, and avoid exposing her husband, her real husband, and yet somehow deflect the polygamous intention of this man who might be a stake president, in some cases apostle, who was courting her. So this created certain problems, even among general authorities. There were several general authorities who never married plural wives, and I haven't listed them here, but they wanted to. And it just never worked out for them. But now I want to look at the women. This focus has been primarily male-oriented because it's been institutionally biased toward church office. But now I'm going to turn that bias in another direction and look at prominent women who were prominent through church office in the LDS Church, but they also became prominent plural wives. And initially I was going to include the women who were, for example, ward primary presidents, relief society presidents, and the list grew too large. And so I narrowed it down to general board members and stake leaders, and still, as you will see, the list is large. I'm going to identify these women by name, and as I think I've organized most of them in terms of what came first chronologically, their church office or their plural marriage. You can see the patterns that began operating in terms of their experience. Some of these names may be familiar to you. I have no way of knowing that. But these women did have prominence, both at the general church level as well as locally. Julia M. Gutke Brixen, YLMIA General Board, 1898 to 1926. Became a plural wife in 1903 of General Board member Lewis Kelch, Sr. Agnes or Aggie S. Campbell, member of the YLMIA General Board from 1898 to 1929. She married Stake Presidency Counselor Edwin T. Benyon as a plural wife in 1904. Amelia Barbara Carling, one of the earliest lady missionaries from 1901 to 1902, she became a plural wife in 1902 of Mission President James G. Duffin, who was her mission president. Hannah Grover, plural wife in 1904 of Victor C. Hegsted, became stake primary president sometime before 1919. If you happen to know when she did, that would be helpful because I don't know the exact date. Lillian Hamlin was a BYU faculty member from 1898 to 1896, that's chronologically out of order. First, she became a plural wife of Apostle Abraham H. Cannon in 1896. Then, following his death as a plural widow, she was a BYU faculty member from 1898 to 1902. While still a faculty member at BYU, she became the plural wife in 1901 of Bishop Lewis M. Cannon. Harriet Benyon Harker became a plural wife in 1899 of Apostle Matthias F. Cowley. She was a member of the Relief Society General Board from 1907 to 1910. Nancy Duella Murphy Humphrey was a plural wife in 1901 of 70, Jabez E. Durfee, and she was a counselor in the stake YLMIA presidency from 1904 to 1912. Martha Jane Lefevre was president of the stake YLMIA. She became a plural wife in 1902 of Elder Mahonry M. Steele, Jr. Mary Lucretia Lyerla, sorry if I'm speaking to a descendant, plural wife in 1899 of Mission President Lewis A. Kelch. She was one of the earliest, she may actually be the earliest lady missionary in 1899, to serve as an independent lady missionary, not to be serving as a matron or whatever they called it in the early days of in the mission home as an extension of her husband's being mission president. Alice Carol McLaughlin was in the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir from 1891 to 93. She became a plural wife in 1899 of Mission President Benny Rich. She became Lady Missionary in 1900. Margaret Pert Cardell became a plural wife in 1900 of Stake Presidency Counselor John M. Cannon, and she was Logan Temple Matron from 1916 to 1943. The late Pert was a plural wife in 1900 of General Board Member Hugh J. Cannon. She served on the Primary General Board from 1906 to 1909. Margaret Curtis Shipp was a physician. She became a plural wife in 1891 of President of 70 Brigham H. Roberts. Catherine Sorensen was Stake Primary President from 1898 to 1904. She became a plural wife in 1903 of Stake Counselor Isaac H. Grace. Bertha Christine Wilkins Stewart was an instructor at Brigham Young College in Logan from 1892 to 1895 and at the LDS Business College from 1896 to 1898. She became a plural wife that year of Stake Presidency Counselor Helaman Pratt, and then she became a counselor in the Stake Relief Society from 1909 to 1912. Clarice Thatcher was a guide at Salt Lake Temple Square. She became a plural wife in 1901 of General Board Member Henry S. Tanner and ended up infuriating a New York reporter who took the tour at Temple Square, asked about the man. She assured him that there had been no plural marriages after the manifesto, and then he found out later she was a plural wife. Pearl Udall became a plural wife in 1904 of Apostle Roger Clausen. She became a member of the YOMIA General Board in 1917. Fanny Woolley, Early Lady Missionary, 1900 to 1902. She became a plural wife in that latter year of Stake President George C. Parkinson and then became a member of the General Board the following year, Primary General Board, excuse me. And the last, Felina Hall Zundel, became a plural wife in 1901 of Stake President Oliver C. Hoskins, and she was a Stake Primary President from 1904 to 1909. With 275 plural marriages that I've identified between September 1890 and December 1904, there's a wide diversity of experience in terms of the males and the females who were involved, and certainly their immediate family, who most often were in on the secret, so to speak, who knew about what was happening, and all of the circumstances involved were different. I mean, it's hard to generalize to say this was a typical plural husband, this was the typical plural wife. But to try to personalize this to some extent for the women, I'd like to give some examples. One is an autobiography of a woman who wrote about her very slow conversion to post-manifesto plural marriage and her eventual acceptance of being a polygamous wife 10 years after the manifesto. Mary Elizabeth Woolley was 26 when 42-year-old Stake President, or Stake Patriarch, asked her to become his plural wife. It was 6 years after the manifesto, right after Utah became a state. She said it was like thunder from a clear sky, and she said it was such a shock that I resented it emphatically. I had never dreamed of such a thing. She'd known him since she was a child. And she said he already had several wives. He had five, in fact, and a large family. And she said any man would be proud of that family, and I thought he'd had enough and should be satisfied with what he had. Then she said, I wasn't aware that when he was a young man, he declared he was going to have 6 wives and 60 children, and he hadn't reached the quota yet. He only had five. Well, she said, I'd always imagined myself as a plural wife. But she resented his proposition to her, his proposal, and she said she was cold and unyielding as steel. She resented every advance he made to her. She was rude. And what really infuriated her, although this was protocol, but still it infuriated her, was that he had already obtained her father's permission and her mother's permission. And they knew about it before she did, which is a way of insulating the prospective plural wife from the pressure of having the man ask her directly. But nonetheless, it just added one more insult to the injury she already felt. And she was angry at her parents, she was angry at him, and she basically said that she was not going to pay any attention to him. And so she said, I had a lot of fun dating a lot of different guys. But he wouldn't give up. And after a year of his continually moaning around to other members of the family about how he wanted to marry this woman, but she wouldn't, her 16-year-old sister said, you're crazy. And you should not just turn him down without giving him even the opportunity, without even getting acquainted with him and with the possibility of romance and marriage. So after her 16-year-old sister gave her this lecture, so to speak, Mary Elizabeth Woolley decided that she'd relent enough to join with the stake patriarch once a week in fasting and prayer about whether it was right to do it. And so they did that for 3 years. She wasn't going to let him off easy. And as far as I know, and as far as she indicated, he did not go from her to somebody else when she gave him this very resentful and really uncooperative response to his proposal. He asked her, and that she was the only one he asked. And finally, she agreed that after 3 years of the weekly fasting and prayer, that yes, I will marry you. And so their polygamous ceremony was performed in 1900. In her autobiography, she says she went to Mexico. It was performed in Salt Lake City. This story, the one I'm going to return to next, it's the only one I know of. There may have been others like this, but I don't have the information on it. And the information that I've got on this is contemporary. It's a set of correspondence between the first wife and the new plural wife. And I have some additional information to fill in, but I'll be referring on and off to the correspondence between them. Helen M. Winters was almost 23 in 1897. She had everything to look forward to, and she was prominent within the church. She was highly educated. She was a college graduate, which in 1897 was an achievement for a woman anywhere in the United States. She loved a young man who said he was going to wait for her, and she was going to wait for him. He was on a mission, a three-year mission, as it turned out, to Germany. He came back from that mission in 1897, and within weeks after his return, they decided that their commitment was right for them, and they were married in the Salt Lake Temple. His father, Wilford Woodruff, performed the ceremony. 3 months later, Wilford Woodruff called her husband to be an apostle, or he was ordained as one of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, Abraham Owen Woodruff, although he was generally known to those who knew him well as Owen. They were deeply in love, and they wanted children right away. And after several months, they became concerned that Helen might not be able to become pregnant. And that concern grew as the time with her not conceiving extended from months into a year and more. In January 1898, Apostle John W. Taylor prophesied that she would bear children, and in fact that her first child would be a son. And beyond that, John W. Taylor prophesied that that son would be born with a cowlick. John W. Taylor was known as the prophet of the quorum, and he was very specific. And this is not folklore. This is recorded in the diary. It's there. 10 months later, however, she still wasn't pregnant. And the conversations of the couple turned toward increasing their family with another wife. And this, in fact, is, I'll just take an aside at this point. This is a common thread that runs through many of the families who entered into plural marriage after 1890. I was going to check my own statistics, and I can't remember. I didn't forget to do it. I referred to them in a review I did of Jesse Embry's really wonderful book on Mormon polygamous families. But in the study of these families, these 275 families, I can't remember now the statistics, so I won't even try to remember it. I'll just say it was a high proportion of the men who became polygamous after 1890 were men whose first wives and only wives had not born children, or that the wives that they had, whether it was a single wife or multiple wives, had gone a significant period of time without bearing children. So that in the mind of the man who married a new plural wife, he had come to the end of the possibility of fathering children with his wife or wives as they existed. And I pointed out that one of the things that I thought might be addressed more in a study of polygamous families is we hear a lot about maternal instinct, but I think among Mormon polygamist men, paternal instinct was extremely strong. And the desire to have children, the desire to have sons, was very powerful. George Buchanan had a very large family, and some of you may here be descended from the Cannon family. And he had multiple wives that he'd married years before the manifesto. Extremely large family, and a very close family. The Cannon family, in some senses, in my perception of the reading of the materials, is one of the most closely knit families, at least at the turn of the century, that I'm aware of. But he had come to the point in his life where none of his wives were able to bear children. It had been, I think, about 8 years since any of his wives had been able or had born a child. And he felt desperate to have more children. He had a very large family. And I think this sense of the desire to have children is a very strong paternal instinct as well that I think needs to be explored and understood to understand plural marriage. And it doesn't matter whether the man has one wife or already has several, if it seems, at least from the statistical evidence alone, that if there was the concern that there would be no more opportunities for fathering children, that husband wanted to have another wife in the home to be able to do that. Well, anyway, going back to Helen and Owen Woodruff, 10 months after the prophecy of John W. Taylor, she was not pregnant. And they prayed that if it was God's will that he marry another wife, and his father had just died that September, Wilford Woodruff, if it was God's will that he marry another plural wife, that God would reveal it in a patriarchal blessing. First, reveal if Helen would have children. Second, if he should marry another wife, whether or not she would have more children. He didn't tell the patriarch any of his concerns. He just went to the patriarch, a local stake patriarch, and asked for a patriarchal blessing, and ticking off the list of questions down the list of the blessing came, you will have children, you will have wives. So, 2 weeks later, Owen Woodruff performed plural marriages. He had a commitment that he was helping others to realize, even though he himself was not prepared yet to do that. In January 1899, she was still not pregnant, and he was almost beside himself this time with concern that they would not be able to share childbirth and having children together. And the apostles, his fellow apostles, knew his worries and his concerns. And Franklin D. Richards, senior member in the quorum at that time in their apostles' meeting, promised Owen, in the name of God, in Jesus Christ, that his wife would bear a son, and also promised him that God's other promises to Owen would also be fulfilled. 11 months later, Helen gave birth to her first child. He was a son, and he had a cowlick. Then in July 1900, Owen spoke in the Auburn, Wyoming ward. He'd never been there before. And as he was speaking, he records in his diary, "Have a peculiar impression." In the audience sat 18-year-old Avery Clark. He later told her, quote, "While I was speaking, it was made known to me that the girl sitting before me would be my wife," unquote. They had never seen one another before. The impression was strong and powerful enough for Owen Woodruff that he asked her father's permission if he could ask her to be a plural wife. But he did not want to ask her himself because they were strangers to one another. So he asked the father if the father would indicate that he had this interest. And so 3 days later, after Apostle Woodruff had been spending frequent time at the house getting acquainted but had said nothing of any kind of romantic in nature, after he had left, the father, when he was no longer there, came to Avery and said, "Apostle Woodruff is a good man. Do you like him?" "Yes, I do. He's a wonderful man. Why wouldn't I like him?" "Well, he would like you to become his wife." Her reaction was, "It's more than I can fully comprehend. I feel puzzled and frightened, but I believe if I keep on praying, I will know in time what is best for me, what is right." That it was like Mary Woolley's reaction. It was like a bolt out of the blue. A month later, Second Counselor Joseph F. Smith told Owen that he should follow the impression of God to him. 6 weeks after that, Owen talked with First Counselor George Buchanan, who also gave his approval. Owen knew better than to ask Lorenzo Snell, and so he didn't. And he felt that having the permission of the first of the, and the second counselor in the first presidency would have to do. And that was true of the other apostles who married. Well, in October, he finally told Helen that he had a specific woman in mind. And as with a lot of things, theory is one thing, reality is another. And Helen now was faced with the reality that there was another woman. Another woman that he was committed to, another woman he wanted to marry, another woman that he would be falling in love with and perhaps was already in love with. And that reality shook Helen, and he recorded in his diary that she was much tried over it. And they had a lot of discussions about it. But this is what Helen wrote to Avery in December 1900. Helen now is 27 years old and pregnant with her second child. She writes to 18-year-old Miss Avery Clark, who she's never met, but she knows her husband is soon to marry. And Avery is attending Brigham Young College. And this is what the first wife says. "Your photo and letter came yesterday, and I'm glad you decided to send them to me. For as you may well imagine, I was very anxious to know something more about you. I know I shall like you, and truly hope we may learn to love each other. No husband could be more kind and considerate than he has been to me. As time passes on, instead of growing indifferent and negligent, he is more thoughtful and attentive to my every wish. I do appreciate this fact, I can assure you. There is so much more in my heart I could tell you, but I think it would not be wise to do so. Write often. Love, Helen." A month later, Avery married Owen at Preston, Idaho. Avery writes, "Before I ever met Helen, she was lifted on a pedestal before my eyes, and I adored her. Owen painted a true picture of her worth and charm, which in all the years I knew her never diminished." Shortly after the plural marriage, Helen wrote another letter to Avery. "Now write me often. Just open your heart to me anytime, and I want to prove to you that I am your sincere friend and will always comfort you and help you whenever I can. I want you to keep all in your heart that I tell you. We must all stand by each other and be a unit in all things. We must one at the head and do his bidding. This is hard for me sometimes, for I have such a strong will of my own. But whenever I do as he says, I am always in the right, And though I cannot always see it at the time, I see it afterwards. Then in March 1902, Helen and Abraham Owen Woodruff joined in the True Order of Prayer in an upper room temple. Because Abraham still wasn't pregnant after more than a year of marriage, and there was that haunting concern whether that would eventually occur. And so Helen and Abe and Owen joined again with the hope and the anticipation of and bringing yet another plural wife into the home. Then in February 1904, Helen has another newborn child. She writes to Avery, who is just 2 months from giving birth to her own first child. "And I hope you will be blessed with a sweet, perfect baby. And I believe you will. And my dear, it will be such a comfort to you." Then she tells Avery that she and Owen have been talking about inviting another wife into the family. Helen says, quote, "I do hope the party will be somebody I can love as much as I do you. Then I would not worry one bit more. I wish you could tell me about that young lady you talked about. You said you liked her. Do you think I would too? I wonder sometimes if it will be her. Well, we must pray earnestly about it, and then I know all will be well." Avery gave birth in April, still planning to add a new wife after the second manifesto in April 1904. Owen and Helen visited Avery and her new child in Mexico, in Colonia Juarez. Then Helen and Avery went with a group of others on an excursion to Mexico City. They were at that time preparing to go on a mission to Germany because President Smith said to Owen, "You wouldn't make a good witness in Washington before the Senate." And so he said, "We're going to call you on a mission to Germany." And so they were making preparations and were anticipating that when they returned to their home in the United States, they'd be basically wrapping up their affairs, preparing to go for a transatlantic trip to Germany. The big question is whether Avery would have joined them there. She probably could have, because in that environment, the concerns and suspicions might not have been as great. But none of those plans could develop, because while Owen and Helen were in Mexico City, they both contracted smallpox, and within a couple of weeks of each other, died of smallpox. Avery said, "It seemed I wept buckets of tears in the days that followed. Two wonderful people who left me well and happy never returned, and their four children made orphans, my own child fatherless, and I was now a widow at age 22. Well, these are different people with different motivations, I think, than probably most people in the audience. Different attitudes toward themselves and toward the church and toward what they understood as the principle for which one should be willing to sacrifice anything necessary in this life. But I think the correspondence between, and particularly on the part of Helen, as a young first wife who had only been with her husband in an exclusive relationship for just a few years before they began discussing the desire on their part of bringing into their home a new plural wife. And those attitudes are important for understanding the motivations that those who entered plural marriage, not only in violation of the laws of the land, but also in violations of the stated public laws of the church, and the motivations that caused these people to feel that they were not only justified but glorified for doing that is something that we need to understand. The paternal instinct I mentioned, the instinct for helping a husband to have that, fulfill that paternal instinct, that was certainly a part of Helen's point of view before she had children of her own. But once she had children of her own, that was no longer her motivation. because her husband now had children. She was bearing children regularly now, to about every 2 years to or less, she was bearing children. So that was not her motivation. Her motivation was trust in two directions. Trust that this was a principle that God did not end with the 1890 Manifesto, and trust that her husband was a godly man whose interest in plural marriage was the same as her interest in plural marriage, and that is primarily for the purpose of fulfilling God's command. And that the romance, that the love, that not only was inevitable, but that she encouraged in between her husband and her husband's other wife, that was not the motivation that, for Helen, at least, was the governing motivation. And she didn't feel it was the governing motivation on the part of her husband. That's hard, I think, to relate to. This is not only a few generations away from us, it is a world away from us. It is a world away from the LDS Church. It is a world view away from the LDS Church. And some people don't relate to that term, that catchphrase, but I think if we look at some examples of how people see the world and see themselves so utterly different than we, and we think, oh, well, they were in the same world. They were in the United States. They were in the church. They believed in the same basic things I believed in, but in such a different way. And this isn't to say that view has died. It has not. We have people in this audience today who are still living the principle, but they are living it defined as rebels from the institutional church. And that is somewhat different. There have been a lot of water has passed under the bridge since Helen wrote her letters to Avery. But it's important for us to understand the female motivation, the male motivation, the institutional motivations for this period of time in which the church was going in opposite directions at the same time. In some senses, like plate tectonics. An eruption was going to happen. It was inevitable. The church could not be going in two different directions at the same time without there being a seismic disturbance. It happened in Nauvoo. It happened again after 1890. And that was inevitable. But it's still important to understand these people in their terms, not in our terms. And it's true for us, whether we are fundamentalists looking past, whether we are believing and institutionally oriented LDS people looking back on this past, or whether we are non-Mormons looking back on this past, or whether we are feminists looking back on this past, or whatever may be those various categories that we can define ourselves as, we cannot project ourselves back on these people. We need to understand them in their terms. And with that, I could go on and talk to you about I had examples of a couple of other apostles and some of their experiences, one who was basically opposed, one who was basically confused. But rather than doing that, I think I'll just turn the time over for questions that you may have. If you don't have questions, then I'll go back to this material and fill in the time. Yes?
In view of all that, why was John W. Taylor communicating for the very same thing?
Well, the question, all right, I'll repeat the questions in each case. In view of all that I've said and all that appears that I haven't said that I didn't take the time to go into about this pattern, why was John W. Taylor excommunicated in 1911? There were a couple of reasons for that. I don't think any one of them was actually sufficient. It was that altogether they brought that about. One of them was that he married a new plural wife in 1909, which was at the very time that the Quorum of the Twelve had established a committee to examine individuals who presumed to enter into new plural marriages, and for one who was an apostle, and John W. Taylor continued to be an apostle until his excommunication, for one who was an apostle to enter into a plural marriage in 1909 absolutely stunned the other members of the Quorum of the Twelve, that he would presume to so openly violate what they understood by 1909 were the absolute clear intentions of the full First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve. But there was more to it than that. There was also the fact that John W. Taylor, because he was angry at the statements of Francis M. Lyman and others and their efforts to end plural marriage, John W. Taylor was circulating a manuscript of and copies and making available to others the original copy of a revelation his father had received in 1886, in which God told John Taylor, president of the church, "I can never revoke this law." Well, John Taylor was circulating that revelation, which the apostles saw as a kind of sedition, as a kind of effort to undermine the church. And then they heard that in October 1910, when the First Presidency announced a letter to all stake presidents for stake presidents to take action against anyone entering into plural marriage after 1904, John Taylor said the church is going to divide in two, and there will be a monogamous church and there will be a polygamous underground. And when that was reported back to the Quorum of the Twelve, they regarded John W. Taylor as not simply a rebel, but as a potential or actual leader of a movement that the apostates could only see as an apostate group. And so when it basically was a foregone conclusion when he came before the Quorum of the Twelve. And he admitted everything except the details of his marriages, which he said he chose not to admit because they were between him and the presidents of the church and God. And he did not discuss those details. But that's why he was excommunicated. Matthias F. Cowley had married a plural wife in 1905 after the Second Manifesto, and had married other men to plural wives and admitted this before the Quorum of the Twelve, but insisted he had done everything that he had done as instructed by a member of the First Presidency. And Francis M. Lyman and Charles W. Penrose and George F. Richards insisted that he be excommunicated. That went down in flames in a vote before the Twelve. Then they retracted and put a new motion that Matthias F. Cowley be disfellowshipped. 9 members of the Quorum of the Twelve voted against that. And so then they finally arrived at a compromise, which is kind of unusual in church courts, but that's what happened. And they agreed that what they would do was to withdraw from Matthias F. Cowley the right to exercise the priesthood. But they would not use the word disfellowship or the punishment that's connected with disfellowshipping. And so that was the punishment he received. He was still an apostle, but they told him that he could not use that priesthood. And his son, who later became an apostle, Matthew Cowley, said that his father gave him father's blessings, but all the ordinances that he and the other children received from that time forward, they had to receive from bishops. They did not receive from their father, even though he was still an apostle. By definition, no one can lose any church office until excommunication. And that's not my definition. That's definition of the First Presidency. So they treated Cowley different because Cowley was, well, everyone loved Matthias F. Cowley. I don't think there's anything around that. He was a very meek man. He was a man, from all the accounts I've read of him, everyone loved. And they had a hard time being angry at Matthias Cowley. And the only reason Heber J. Grant remained angry at Matthias Cowley for decades and refused to allow Matthias F. Cowley to become a full member of the church in good standing was that Matthias F. Cowley once lied in front of the Quorum of the Twelve about promising Heber J. Grant that he would perform a plural marriage for him. And Heber J. Grant had a long memory, and he could not forgive his close friend for lying and making him out to be a liar, making Apostle Grant out to be a liar by denying that Cowley had said that to him, which Cowley had. So that's the reason he held a grudge, but he still loved Callie. He just was angry and kept that anger smoldering for decades until 1936, when the first presidency and Quorum of the Twelve reinstated Matthias F. Callie. Yes, at the back. I don't think we'd need to call it an estimate. The question is concerning the 1886 revelation that was given to John Taylor. What is my estimate or view of the authenticity of that revelation? I don't see that there can be any question, but that revelation is authentic. Anyone who calls it an alleged revelation or disputed revelation or tries to challenge its authenticity is whistling in the dark, as far as I'm concerned. The Quorum of the Twelve discussed that revelation. When the manifesto, the Data Manifesto, was first discussed by the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, John W. Taylor referred to that revelation. And then in another discussion of plural marriage, when the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency were discussing whether they should sign an appeal to the President of the United States for general amnesty and promise to teach the people that it was their intent to make sure that everyone abided by the understanding of the manifesto, which by 1892 not only prohibited new plural marriages, it also prohibited by church decree cohabiting with plural wives married before 1890. That was the official church position from October 1891 onward. And during that discussion in the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency, in their consultations, they discussed again the 1886 manifesto. No one challenged John W. Taylor's reference to it, and John W. Taylor didn't reference that it gave him the right to marry as many wives as he wanted or anything that he later was perceived by the Twelve as saying. He just said, there are things I don't understand. And I don't understand, first of all, the manifesto, the first day he brought it up in view of this revelation. Then he said, I don't understand how we can continue to proclaim that we're going to deny this and teach people against it in view of this revelation. And John W. Taylor had given this revelation to the president of the church shortly after the death of John W. Taylor. He had found a number of revelations by his father that have never been published in the Doctrine and Covenants, and he just sent them cover mail envelope to Wilfred Woodruff, who was then the senior apostle. And somebody who knew John Taylor, like Melvin J. Ballard, once wrote when asked about it, I'm very well acquainted with President John Taylor's handwriting, and it's obviously John Taylor's handwriting. That's what Melvin J. Ballard, an apostle, said. Those are not my words. But I don't feel that you can question the legitimacy of that revelation, especially when that revelation was much shorter and in much less detail than other revelations that unquestionably were recorded and published. John Taylor received a revelation in 1882 that said, you can't preside over my priesthood. No one can preside over my priesthood unless they have entered into this law. And the church itself published that revelation in 1882. And it was published, then a revelation also appeared, and I think it was a Danish and another, there were two foreign language editions of the Doctrine and Covenants it appeared in. Far more explicit than the 1886 revelation, Wilfred Woodruff himself received two revelations, one in 1880, one in 1889, which said, you cannot give up this principle. It is an eternal principle. Much longer revelations, and people all over the church recorded these in their diaries, because he recorded it twice in his diary, the apostles recorded it. So I think it's really, if I can understand a defensive reason ecclesiastically for questioning the 1886 revelation because it has been used as a cornerstone for Mormon fundamentalist claims. However, those claims, if they're going to be challenged, have to be challenged on another ground. You cannot challenge it, those claims, by denying the existence of the 1886 revelation. If you do, you're undermining your argument, for one thing. It's too easy to demonstrate that that revelation, in fact, is valid. Yes? Did everyone hear that? Did anyone not hear that question? Okay. Oh, I'll repeat it for the tape. Okay. The question is, how about children of those who entered into plural marriage after between 1890 and 1904? How many of their children entered into plural marriage? I've tried to trace that as far as I could. And in fact, if you have the details and references about that case you just indicated, Walter Young, appreciative of those, because I've tried to follow as far down as I can the relations of generational entry into plural marriage. In some cases, fathers and sons both entered into plural marriage during the period 1890 to 1904. For example, Mariner W. Merrill performed the only marriages he performed, aside from performing a marriage for Matthias Cowley. The only marriages that Mariner W. Merrill, as Logan Temple president, performed were for members of his own family. This began in 1894 when he performed a plural marriage in the Logan Temple for his... Then he performed another plural marriage in the Logan Temple in 1896 for one of his sons. And then he performed a marriage in a Salt Lake hotel room for another one of his sons in 1901. And then he performed a last plural marriage in the Logan Temple in 1905 for another one of his sons. He himself married a plural wife in 1901. And so you have two generations involved in plural marriage even during that same period, 1890 to 1904. Statistically, however, not very many children of men and women who entered into plural marriage between 1890 and 1904 entered into plural marriages after that time. In view of the number of children born, the number of children who would be eligible, very few entered into plural marriages after 1904. Some did, but we're talking about a very small minority of the possible group who could have. Yes?
Michael,
yes?
Self-performed 7 plural marriages.
No, he signed recommends for 12. The question was, the day Wilford Woodruff presented the manifesto for the sustaining vote of the October conference, the question was, did he perform plural marriages that day? No, he did not perform plural marriages that day, but he signed the recommends for about six or seven plural marriages to be performed in Mexico. And because of the distance of traveling and people making individual arrangements, the last of those plural marriages was not performed until mid-December 1890. Well, which individual? Are all of them? Everybody? Okay. The question is, what basis for marriage dates am I using in general, and then specifically for B.H. Roberts? The marriage dates come from a variety of sources. In some cases, I have the Sealing Record references. Those were very rare, though. In most cases, in some cases, they were even recorded by the First Presidency, but that was not very many of them. In most cases, record of them was maintained by the person who performed the ceremony, as well as by the family for whom it was performed. It was basically a return to the practices of Nauvoo plural marriage, where there were no official records of Nauvoo plural marriages. You look in vain for them. The first official records of Nauvoo plural marriages are the plural marriages performed in the Nauvoo temple, which have confused a lot of people because children were sometimes born before those plural marriages in the Nauvoo temple. And the reason for that was that most of the plural marriages that you first show up on any official record in the Nauvoo temple had been performed between a year and a half to, in some cases, 2 years before the dedication of the Nauvoo temple. And they were simply resealed in the Nauvoo temple for permanent record within the house of the Lord. So in many cases, in most cases, I'm depending on diaries, records that were kept by the officiators or by the family members, not very often by, quote, official records that were maintained in like a bound book, although I do have had some reference to those too, but not very many. With reference to B.H. Roberts, the date in 1891, I don't have a specific date for that. The B.H. Roberts, the marriage, the civil marriage you're referring to with Maggie Shipp Robert, or Maggie Curtis Shipp Roberts, was in, I think, 1922, when he was on the way to the Eastern States Mission. And by that time, she was his sole wife. He no longer had any other wife at that time. I think Celia had died just prior to that. And that was the other remaining wife, and he married Maggie on the way to New York.
Well, preceded, though, the attempted divorce with Milford Bard.
Yes, they were divorced in March 1890, Milford Bard Shipp. But I connected correspondence from one of Milford Bard's other wives, Ellis Shipp Reynolds, or Ellis Reynolds Shipp, where she was corresponding concerning references to Maggie, and where Maggie had moved following her separation from B.H. Roberts, and she identified which ward she'd moved into. And I checked the ward records, and she moved into that ward after the manifesto was issued. She didn't move into the ward until the time of, she didn't move into that ward prior to the time of the manifesto. And then from another couple of diaries of friends, social friends of the Roberts, the woman who was very close and entertaining both Maggie and B.H. Roberts during the time of their courtship later made a statement in an interview that the marriage occurred after the manifesto, and she had been entertaining them in her home during the time they were secretly courting. The date, though, I don't have. As far as I can tell, it was in 1891 because of other references to the travel of Junius F. Wells during the time when the marriage was performed in his home. Yes? Well, the major problem with the question of how do you deal with the 132, section 132, or the revelation of 1843 about plural marriage and the eternity of marriage for time and eternity and new and everlasting covenant of marriage, its various names, how do you understand the references to concubines, which is a part of that revelation? And which is that revelation doesn't say that reference to concubines is of any less importance than any other reference in the revelation. So it becomes a question: what do we mean by concubines? Well, it's hard to know what they understood by concubines. In my understanding is that in the biblical time when the phrase was used and it was in its translation, it was understood to mean a lesser wife, a wife of lesser status than the first wife. And that was particularly true because the women who were frequently identified as concubines, of whether we're looking at Abraham or others, were former slaves or servants in the home who then became wives. And because they were of a lower social status before their marriage, they continued to be lower after their marriage and were called concubines. That's my understanding. If we have a biblical scholar here, I will gladly stand corrected if that's wrong. As we look at Mormons, how did they understand the term? That may have no bearing whatever on what the term originally meant as a term in the Bible. They use it without defining what they mean by it. Brigham Young said the day will come when there will be wives and concubines. Even after the manifesto, Lorenzo Snow, who curiously expressed this, even though he was opposed to new plural marriages, he said there will be wives and concubines. And what that meant, it's not clear whether this meant a wife who was of just simply lesser social status or what. My own view is that in practical terms, there were concubines, and that their marriage ceremony was of a different nature than the marriage ceremony of 99.9% ivory plural wives. And that is that these women entered into a marriage that was not performed by an officiator. They entered into a marriage of solemn covenant with their husband. And the first such marriage I have record of is the one I referred to in the dialogue article. Apostle Willard Richards entered into such a marriage in October and November 1845. Why he did so, I have no idea. Because his cousin, Brigham Young, was performing marriages, and he easily could have turned to Brigham Young to perform this marriage. But instead, he records the words, in fact, of the ceremony, of solemn covenant between Willard Richards and this new wife. And when Willard Richards went into the temple to be sealed to other women who had been married to him in kind of routine, if I can call that word, I mean regularized temple, or rather sealing ceremonies, this woman that he'd entered into with in this covenant of marriage was not among those to whom he was resealed in the Nauvoo temple. And I think in practice, these women are Mormon concubines, women who, for one reason or another, entered into solemn marriage covenants with their husbands rather than having a plural marriage performed. The last most prominent one involved Richard R. Lyman, who his plural wife, whom he was married to for 18 years before he was discovered and excommunicated, he had entered into a solemn covenant of marriage with in 1925. And so there are a few instances of this, but they're very rare. And generally when the authorities of the church use the term concubine, they never explain what they mean.
Can you give us some kind of idea as to post-manifesto and how many were temple?
All right, the question is, for post-manifesto plural marriages, how many were civil and how many were temple? If you mean by that, when first performed, if they were civil marriages, when first performed, there were relatively few, but there were a few. And what happened is, and it's a curiosity in the law, but it nonetheless is true, that if you are engaged in a relationship that the law does not recognize as marriage, then you can continue in that relationship and enter into a relationship that the law does consider marriage, and the law will ratify this second relationship, because that's the only one the law is concerned about, if it complies with the law's definition of marriage. So plural marriages, by definition, were null and void in the law. So if a man had a legal wife and a plural wife, and the legal wife died, leaving him with a plural wife, by law, he was at liberty to marry another civil wife. In the eyes of the law, his legal wife had died, he was simply marrying another legal wife. In reality, he already had a wife, and his now legal wife was his new plural wife, because he already had a pre-existing wife. But because of the legal technicality, he was marrying another legal wife, and she remained his only legal wife. This is the only plural marriage that Francis M. Lyman performed, and he knew exactly what he was doing. There was a stake president who had a civil marriage and a plural wife, and the plural wife was beyond childbearing, and the first wife died, and the stake president wanted to have more children. And he came to Francis M. Lyman and said that this was the situation. And Francis M. Lyman said, if your civil wife has died, you are at complete liberty to marry a new plural wife. And this went all the way up. And it wasn't just something they arranged on the side. That was not Francis M. Lyman's way. He brought this all the way up to a meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency in the temple. And they approved it. And when the first wife began complaining, they said, send somebody to her and tell her she's wrong. Not the first wife, but the pre-existing legal wife. Pre-existing plural wife. Getting mixed up here. The pre-existing plural wife. The plural wife who was still alive, but the man was at liberty civilly to marry a new wife. She complained of what he was planning to do to the president of the church. And the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency had already decided, this is okay. So they sent somebody to her to say, we've decided this is all right. You're going to have to accept this. And so Francis M. Lyman took the stake president into the Salt Lake Temple and performed this civil plural marriage with a license and all that was connected with it in the temple, knowing full well that this was a de facto plural marriage. But because of the technicality of the law, this marriage was safe. It was a legal civil marriage. That's the only one, any kind of plural marriage that Francis M. Lyman performed.
Were they marrying each other?
Okay, the question is, were they marrying? Well, in view of the secrecy, were men who were involved in post-manifesto plural marriage giving their daughters to other men who wanted post-manifesto plural wives? That happened occasionally, but it happened generally because these men, some of these men who entered into post-manifesto plural marriages had marriages extending back generations, so that they had daughters of marriageable age in 1895, 1896, 1900. But this wasn't a common pattern because I haven't divided it out, but my perception is that three-fourths or so of those who entered into plural marriage before did not have children of marriageable age, perhaps even higher than that. So they really, statistically, they couldn't be swapping in this way as you suggested.
Do you have any information on the history of
that? The question is, aside from the 1886 revelation, fundamentalists based their claim on a council meeting that was held when this revelation was discussed, a council meeting in which, according to those who later told of it, John Taylor ordained men with a special authority of high priest apostle, and an authority which allowed them to perform plural marriages irrespective or regardless of what the church might do. And that because of that commission, whence the church, in the fundamentalist terms, became out of order and was no longer practicing plural marriage, no longer authorizing plural marriages, and moving away from other essentials or elements of 19th century Mormonism, then those who had this authority, who had received that, could maintain the not only the principle, but also other teachings, a whole series of things in addition to plural marriage in their purity, doctrinal and otherwise. I'll have to admit that, acknowledge that within this claim there is two basic divisions within the fundamentalist movement, if I think I can call it that. That there are those Mormon fundamentalists who feel that maintaining plural marriage and perpetuating plural marriage was all these men were authorized to do, that they were not authorized to do anything else but perform the ordinances necessary to keep plural marriage alive. There are others who feel that authority was so comprehensive that as the church itself went farther and farther out of order institutionally, that the community of believers that is a part of the fundamentalist following could be organized in a kind of church manner with ordinances and organizations that in some sense mimic or reflect those of the LDS Church, and that also was a part of this commission. So there are two kind of splits in attitude among fundamentalists, and those who feel it's plural marriage only do regard with criticism fundamentalists who have used that authority designation for organizations and things that other fundamentalists, generally in the minority actually though, tend to feel should not be used for any organizational purpose. All right, going back to the original question, what about this council? Is there a historical basis for it? There may, in fact, be historical basis for it, but as a historian, I can't answer that question. All I can say is I have not seen historical evidence of it that is earlier than the 1920s. It is based on detailed statements by Lauren Woolley and some partial statements by his father, John W. Woolley, and also by another witness at that meeting. And we can tell from diaries that these people were, in fact, at that meeting. It's what happened at the meeting that's a question. Daniel Bateman is another one who in the 1920s also made affidavits about this setting apart. But now that's 50 years after the fact. And if you find nothing earlier than 50 years after a particular claimed fact, for historians, that's an uncomfortable situation to be in order to affirm the existence of something for which you have no reference until 50 years later. And so It may have historical basis, but right now I have not seen contemporary historical evidence for it. I think that's the best way for me to answer your question. Yes, at the back. Well, your question is in two parts, I think. One part of the question is there is no, as you, or kind of a statement, there is no contemporary evidence for the charismatic claims connected with this meeting that fundamentalists have proclaimed. And then two, could there have in fact been many, many men set apart or ordained to perform plural marriages due to what John W. Taylor said in 1911? Going back to your claim or statement about the charismatic side, actually there is a lot of contemporary evidence for the charismatic claims of Lauren C. Woolley. What is lacking is contemporary evidence for the setting apart and ordination. Lauren C. Woolley was telling this basic story about John Taylor communing with John, with Joseph Smith and Jesus Christ in the home of John Woolley. He was telling that story as early as 1893. Long before there was any second movement in the church or underground movement in the church that would require those kinds of claims. Diary references as early as the 1886, 1887, 1888 period refer to people reporting that they had heard that John Taylor had been speaking with Jesus Christ face to face somewhere on the underground. So there is contemporary and very close to the event evidence for those charismatic claims. Maybe not every one of them, but for a number of them. But I find no contemporary evidence for the setting apart or the ordination. That is not to say it didn't exist. It's just absence of evidence is not evidence. Just because you say, I found nothing on it, you can't say it didn't happen. All you can say is, I found nothing on it. Historians get uncomfortable trying to debate the existence or non-existence of an event for which the essential claim has no evidence earlier than 50 years after the event is supposed to have occurred. The question is, do the Mormon fundamentalists have a theologically tenable claim for the continuation of Mormon polygamy? You may as well ask me, do Hasidic Jews have a theologically tenable claim for their form of Judaism? All theological claims are tenable. Yes. The question is, do I feel confident that I have identified most or nearly all or all of the plural marriages that occurred between 1890 and 1904? No, I can't really claim that kind of confidence. What I can claim is that I think that with many years of plowing through a lot of sources, I think I can claim that I have identified a large majority of the plural marriages performed within the church or by church authority or within priesthood authority, whatever term you're going to use, between 1890 and 1904. But I don't know that I can say I've claimed 3/4 or 2/3 or 80%, because that would mean I would have a sense of how many total there are, and I really don't. I think I've pretty well identified all I can, but people keep mentioning new ones to me. So, as I'm able to, I would like to investigate those. The only way to really know that you've identified all of those is to have the sealing records of all the officiators. That's the best evidence. And I only have that in a few cases, although they're pretty good, but they're not everybody who was involved, and because they're not everyone who was involved, I can't be confident that I have identified all the plural marriages. Yes. Yes. What's the evidence on this claim to the statement of John Taylor that there were hundreds of men and even set apart? Thank you. I'm sorry. I did forget that second part of the question. The question was, what evidence is there, according to John W. Taylor, that there were hundreds of men? John W. Taylor was actually, I think somewhat flippantly, but somewhat seriously too, he was quoting his father. And his father, when asked in, I think it was 1884, in a court case about, what knowledge do you have about plural marriages being performed? And John Taylor's response was, I have no idea. There are hundreds of men who have the authority to perform plural marriages. I don't know how many have been performed. Well, this was a way of shielding him from knowledge. The word know means so many things in so many places. And what they wanted to do was to be able to say, I do not know. I do not have knowledge of the plural marriage. If they had wanted to fill in all the gaps, they could have said, yes, I signed the recommends for this marriage. Yes, I saw the couple enter the room with the officiator. Yes, the officiator reported back to me that he had performed the marriage ceremony. Yes, it has been recorded in the Endowment House or Salt Lake Temple plural marriage book. Or not Salt Lake Temple, it'd be St. George. But no, I don't know. I have no knowledge of the marriage being performed. That was the kind of defensive semantic game they were playing. And it was not totally uncontrolled. It became so after the manifesto, because the president really did not want to know. John Taylor wanted to know. He had stake presidents writing to him asking for permission for men to enter into plural marriage, and he wanted to have his fingers on those lines of delegation. But after the manifesto, the presidents did not want to know. In fact, if you wanted to horrify Wilford Woodruff after about October 1890, all you had to do was come up to him and say, gee, President Woodruff, I really would like a plural wife, and we made promises to one another before the manifesto was published. And that was one way to guarantee you were going to raise his blood pressure, because he did not want to know. He did not want you to ask him that. He did not want to know your name or who you were or what you wanted. He wanted somebody else to know that. And so that was what John Taylor, W. Taylor was referring to. There were not hundreds after the manifesto who were delegated to perform plural marriage. There were very few, and they were all institutionally based. They were apostles. They were stake presidents, two stake presidents. They were two patriarchs. Things started getting funny, though, after 1906 particularly. But even after 1904, then you have the emergence of a separate channel for new plural marriages. And it overlaps with the traditional channel, the institutional channel, that claims rights through institutional lines of bar and graph authority. Just one or two more questions. Yes.
You made a statement that John W. is the same as the others that he's made.
Those who are willing to stand, who consider yourself Mormons, how many of you are adhering in one way or another to the principle? No one wants to stand. All right, I know some of you here. I won't ask you to stand. I have interviewed many of these people. I have seen more than 1,000 of them in one location. Yes, in fact, there are two churches. How you define it is a different thing. But there are two Mormonisms. The LDS Church may say these people are not of the LDS Church, and technically that's true. 3/4 of Mormon fundamentalists today have never been baptized members of the LDS Church. Never. But there are, in fact, two streams of Mormonism. Well, one is a revelation, the other one wasn't. That's a pretty clear one, clear choice. And if somebody calls me on that, I can quote Joseph F. Smith, who furiously, he embarrassed the rest of the first presidency in Quorum of the Twelve by furiously denying that the manifesto was a revelation. This discussion happened about 1898. And George Q. Cannon was taking the point of view that the manifesto was a revelation, even though he was authorizing people to enter into plural marriages after the manifesto. He said the manifesto was a revelation, and Joseph F. Smith was so furious. I don't know what he said. I mean, all of the diaries at the time, and I doubt you'd even find it in the minutes, because they sanitized their minutes, but the diarists were just, they were absolutely stunned at what he said. I mean, he was so furious in denying that the manifesto was a revelation. And they required him to apologize 2 weeks later for what he had said as a personal attack on George Q. Cannon. So, no, that's the difference. One's a revelation, thus saith the Lord. The other one is a statement of policy, thus saith the President of the Church.
To do something secretly that you had
Well, that internal tension wasn't just us versus them, rank and file versus the apostles. It was within the Quorum of the Twelve. They were perplexed by this. There were some who felt very confident and comfortable with the situation. Most did not, particularly those who sustained Lorenzo Snow. This was the period in which it was probably the most intense, when Lorenzo Snow was telling the Quorum of the Twelve over and over and over again, I will not authorize anyone to enter into a plural marriage anywhere in the United States, anywhere in Mexico, anywhere in Canada, anywhere in the United States. I don't care what his position is. No one can enter into a plural marriage by God's authority. I bar my authority. And then his counselors were authorizing people to enter into plural marriages. And I don't know the counselor's point of view, but I do know the apostle's point of view, and it was a tension-filled situation. They felt uncomfortable with it. And some of the general authorities at the time expressed in their diaries, I don't understand what is happening. Literally those words. Because they'd have one apostle tell them that absolutely not, you are committing close to sin by even discussing the possibility of plural marriage after the manifesto. And another apostle saying, do you have a wife picked out yet? As soon as you do, I'll perform the marriage for you. And these other general authorities were saying, I cannot understand this. So the tension was very real, and it was at all levels. Yes? No.
Really?
He knew about George Buchanan, but he defined that in his mind as something that as Wilford Woodruff had set up, and he did not want to know when it stopped. He just did not want to inquire about it.
He did not want to know.
But he kept telling everybody, I don't authorize anyone to do it. No one can do it by my authority as president of the church, and I'm the only one who has the keys. So he hoped, my feeling is he hoped he wouldn't have to ask and that it would stop because he said it had to stop, but it didn't.
Okay.